and welcome to this bonus episode this week of the Theology Mom podcast. I did a live stream earlier today over at the Center for Biblical Unity, and I did a little teaching conversation, I don't know what you want to call it, on the issue of representation, which is building on the discussion that I had last week on diversity. And so I've decided to repopulate that conversation over here on my podcast. And I do hope you find this helpful. And be sure to let me know your feedback about this and if it's helping you and other conversations you would like to see CFBU do along these lines. And with that, here is the conversation. All right. Welcome to Thursday. Welcome to the family meeting. If you go to your favorite app store, whether you're Apple or Android, for the 10 people who follow the ministry who are on Android phones, you can go in there and search for Center for Biblical Unity and get the app. And that's really the best way to be able to browse all of our podcasts across all our platforms, as well as articles, blogs, white papers, all of that, and events. If you want to know if we are coming to a town near you, you definitely want to be on the app. So go check out Center for Biblical Unity app. And this is really one of the best ways to stay connected with us. Do not rely on social media to help you stay connected to the ministry. As we have seen with the big social media outage last week, we can lose contact with our account at any time. And big tech is not our friend. Our posts are very censored and throttled. And so if you really want to know what's happening at the ministry, you're going to have to get the app, as well as subscribe to our weekly digital newsletter. And all you have to do, this is literally going to take you 5 seconds, literally. All you have to do is go to centerforbiblicalunity.com and wait 2 seconds, and a little pop-up window will come up. Just enter your name and your zip code and your email address, and we will send you a link to a free ebook written by our friend Dr. Harold Felder, addressing the question, why is Christianity a white man's religion? So get that for free when you sign up, but then you will also sign up to receive our weekly digital newsletter. Comes every Sunday if we're not out of town. If we are out of town, it usually comes on Monday when I get around to doing it. That way you can stay connected to the ministries. Now, last week I did a conversation, kind of a little bit of a quasi training, that I called Diversity Explained. And I went through what I call the noble vision or the noble version of diversity, and then what diversity looks like when it comes to be shaped by the critical social theories. And if you would like more information about what the critical social theories are and a deeper dive into where they contradict the Christian worldview and where they agree with the Christian worldview in a couple of key moments, we would recommend our friends, Dr. Neil Shenvey and Dr. Pat Sawyer, their book, Critical Dilemma. You're going to get a nice, big, thick book-length treatment with hundreds of footnotes and citations to support their claims about the critical social theories. So go check that out. So I'm going to kind of pick it up where I left off last week in our conversation about diversity, and talk to you today about a related concept called representation. Now, representation is connected to diversity. So if you go talk to your friendly neighborhood chief diversity officer in your workplace, they can probably explain to you all the details of it. But the true, like, kind of bottom line of the whole thing is that diversity is really about what your workplace looks like and recruiting talent and that sort of thing. But representation is an idea that takes diversity further. And I'm going to just briefly quote here from an article. This is from the gloat.com website. So it rhymes with goat, but it's gloat, GLOAT.com. And they have an article on their website called Representation and Diversity, what are the differences and why do they matter? And I'm just going to read a couple of key things here from the article. Most organizations recognize that promoting diversity needs to be a priority in the new world of work. Nearly one out of two CEOs view building a more equitable workplace as one of their top challenges. And if I have time, maybe we'll do a conversation 1 week on the word equity. While 61% of workers think diversity and inclusion strategies are beneficial and essential, I always wonder about those numbers. How many people mark that box simply because they're trying to keep their job? Anyways, although leaders and employees may see eye to eye to the importance of equity, again, a term we have not explained yet, many diversity and inclusion initiatives are overlooking a crucial component, and that's essential for driving lasting change, and that is representation. While diversity is about bringing people together from all walks of life, in other words, bringing people together in your workplace from diverse backgrounds, representation ensures that these diverse employees and their viewpoints can be found or depicted across all departments. And here's the key part, and seniority levels within the organization. So diversity is kind of the doorway through which people come. Representation is seen as the sustaining of those people to make a meaningful contribution to the organization, particularly at the leadership level. So we're going to get into this today and trying to understand representation. And here I'm going to, once again, I'm going to give kind of the noble version of representation and then where it leads when you turn it into kind of an all-encompassing epistemology and way of knowing and way of being, okay? So what is the problem that representation is trying to solve? Let's kind of backwards engineer it here a little bit. My best understanding of what the problem is that there is here's how the argument generally goes, is that there is a promotion of whiteness. And we're going to get into a little bit about what whiteness means, but the short version of it is whiteness is referring to the values, culture, and practices of Western civilization, and is at worst inherently racist, or at best not diverse. And this is where diversity, equity, and inclusion, and for today's conversation, representation, are seen as part of the cure. So this is the problem. We have to understand what the ailment is. What is the sickness to which diversity and representation is the cure? Well, it is whiteness. This is the sickness. This is the thing that must be dismantled and overcome. Because at its worst, whiteness is inherently racist. And at its best, it is simply not diverse. Okay? So let's talk a little bit more and drill down on the term whiteness. And we're going to do our best to try to define it a little bit. So we're going to look at what I'm going to call anti-racism's definition of whiteness. And this would be based on the work of people like Ibram X. Kendi or Robin DiAngelo. So this refers to the way that white people, their customs, culture, and beliefs operate as the standard by which all other groups are compared. That's the key word there, is standard. The idea at the core is it is an idea that at the core of understanding race and racism in America. So if you really want to understand what the race problem is in America, it is that whiteness has been used as the standard for what is considered normal or beautiful or true or good, okay? And that this normalization of racial identity throughout America's history is what has created a culture where non-white people are seen as inferior or abnormal or crazy or stupid and that sort of a thing. And so this is often the kinds of things that you will hear as to the problem in any of our Western countries. And this is what whiteness is. Let's continue. Whiteness, and this is from the Smithsonian Museum of African American History, defines it as white dominant culture operates as a social mechanism that grants advantages to white people since they can navigate society both by feeling normal and being viewed as normal. I want you to notice those words because that is a core principle of whiteness, and that whiteness is the standard, supposedly, by which everything is judged as normal, okay? Persons who identify as white rarely have to think about their racial identity because they live within a culture where whiteness has been normalized. So these are kind of the textbook definitions, if you will, more of the standard definitions that are widely used in culture. Now, other people will use the term whiteness in different ways, and we will get into that later on. Okay. So a couple of years ago, the Smithsonian released this infographic, and this is a good sort of popular level survey in graphic form of what is often meant by whiteness. It's white culture in the United States, aspects and assumptions of whiteness and white culture. Things like rugged individualism, self-reliance, independence and autonomy, individuals assumed to be in control of their environment. You get what you deserve, sowing and reaping. Family structure, the nuclear family, mother, father, you know, two children is the ideal social unit. Husband is the breadwinner, head of household. Wife is the homemaker, subordinate to the husband. Children should have their own rooms. I don't know where they're getting that. Emphasis on the scientific method, objective, rational, linear thinking, cause and effect relationships, quantitative emphasis. History, based on Northern European immigrants' history as opposed to Eastern European immigrants. Heavy focus on the British Empire, primacy of Western, meaning Greek and Roman, and the Judeo-Christian position. A tradition. Protestant work ethic. Hard work is the key to success. Work before play. If you didn't meet your goals, you didn't work hard enough. Religion. Christianity is the norm. Anything other than the Judeo-Christian tradition is foreign. There's no tolerance for deviation from this single God concept. Let's go over to the other side here. We've got status, power, and authority. Wealth equals worth. Your job is who you are. Respect for authority. Heavy value on ownership of goods, space, and property. Future orientation. Plan for the future. Delayed gratification. Progress is always best. Tomorrow will be better. Time. Following time schedules. Time viewed as a commodity. Have you ever heard the saying, like, you know, time is something you can't buy? That would be a white culture, whiteness idea. Aesthetics based on European culture, steak and potatoes, bland. Women's beauty based on blonde and thin Barbie. Man's attractiveness based on economic status, power, and intellect. Holidays based on Christian holidays, based on white history and male leaders. justice based on English common law, protect property and entitlements, intention counts, competition, be number one, win at all costs, winner-loser dichotomy, master and control nature, must always do something in a situation, aggressiveness and extroversion. If you're an extrovert, you're displaying whiteness. Decision-making, majority rules when whites have power. Communication, King's English, written tradition, avoid conflict and intimacy, don't show emotion, don't discuss your personal life, and be polite. Okay, so again, this is an infographic from the Smithsonian from a couple of years ago. After they put it up, they quickly removed it, but you know, the internet's a funny place. Once you have something go viral, it's really hard to get rid of it. But I think that this is a helpful kind of colloquial summary of how a lot of people think about whiteness. And again, this is not an academic definition. This is more of a popular or lay level definition and perception. But isn't it interesting that things like the nuclear family, a mother and a father and children, private property, the English common law system of justice, these are concepts that are not just part of the Western tradition. These are concepts that are deeply embedded in the Christian worldview. Things like work, having a work ethic, working hard, and respect for authority. So there's some of these things that I think, you know, maybe we could have a conversation about being cultural, like, you know, keeping to yourself, minding your own business, that sort of thing. But, you know, some of these things, if we were to dismantle them, we would end up dismantling important aspects of ways that Christianity and Judaism have impacted and shaped the culture. And so, and this is why when we play it all the way out, socialists will look at something like this and say, these are all things that must be dismantled. And they will sometimes even go so far as to use the term whiteness as a shorthand way of talking about these are all the things that need to be dismantled. And particularly like not just private property, but they start to see all of these things and all of life as property, even down to children and that sort of a thing. So it is important to at least have a basic understanding of what people mean when they talk about whiteness. What is that? So if this is the problem, if the problem is whiteness, then what is the cure? Well, the cure is to add diversity and increasing representation so minority people can, quote unquote, see themselves. This is a very important saying that they have in various contexts and to build empathy in white people. In other words, for white people to have more empathy. That's sort of poorly worded on that slide. But the idea of for the minority to see themselves in various contexts, particularly in leadership, and for the white people to have more empathy. This is the cure. And part of that cure involves eventually, if you take it all the way down, is to dismantle whiteness. All of those things that we saw on that infographic. But before we get into that, I want to take you all the way back to 1990. Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop published an essay called Windows, Mirrors, and Sliding Glass Doors. It's a very short essay. So this essay, you can go look it up. I don't know if you've ever heard of the entity called Reading is Fundamental. It was kind of a big thing when I was a kid. I used to see their ads on television, like as public service announcement, encouraging kids to read. And Dr. Bishop had written a short essay as part of the Reading is Fundamental group. And it's a very interesting essay, and it has been used as kind of a foundation that, especially in the education sector, is often used to try to bring forward a vision for representation. And this essay was about the importance of providing young readers with diverse books that reflect the quote-unquote multicultural nature of the world in which we live. And Dr. Bishop is kind of the one, apparently, is credited, we'll put it that way, with coming up with the phrase to help children see themselves in books, and how when they see themselves in books, it helps them understand themselves better, but it also helps white children, non-minority children, to understand and learn about the lives of minorities through books. And this essay, this very short little essay, played a pivotal role in developing kind of the foundational concept of representation. And I'm going to have Bob put the essay on the screen right now. And again, it's called Mirrors, Windows, and Sliding Glass Doors. And any of you who are working in public education, you may have read this essay. It's out there in the kind of multicultural literacy space. Literature, I'm going to read some excerpts from the article here. Literature transforms human experiences and reflects it back to us. And in that reflection, we can see our own lives and experiences as part of the larger human experience. Reading then becomes a means of self-affirmation, and readers often seek their mirrors in books. And so what the author's trying to say here is that books become a mirror for us as we read about somebody in a book and we can identify with their experience. We start to see that I'm not the only one. We start to feel like we're less lonely and we're less isolated, and we can see our own experience as part of the larger human experience. All right, scroll down a little bit. All right, a former colleague at the University of Massachusetts, Sonia Nieto, found that in the decade between 1972 and 1982, an average of only 5.5 books a year were published about Puerto Ricans. A perusal of my shelves of review books and new and adjacent publisher catalogs indicate that if we were to examine the past 8 years, keeping in mind this article was written in 1990, the numbers are likely to be the same, if not lower. Stories about contemporary Mexican Americans are few and far between. Contemporary Asian and contemporary Native Americans do not fare much better. The largest number of books about so-called minority groups is about Afro-Americans. The number of books about Afro-Americans has increased considerably, despite a major decrease of such books in the early and mid-80s. And here's the key to it. When children cannot find themselves reflected in the books they read, or when the images they see are distorted, negative, or laughable, then they learn a powerful lesson about how they are devalued in society of which they are a part. Our classrooms need to be places where all children from all cultures that make up the salad bowl of American society can find their mirrors. They can find someone, in other words, who looks like them. Children from dominant social groups, in this context, we're talking about white people, white children, have always found their mirrors in books. But they, too, have suffered from the lack of availability of books about others. They need the books as windows onto reality, not just on imaginary worlds. They need books that will help them understand the multicultural nature of the world in which they live, and their place as a member of just one group, as well as our connections to all other humans. So here is the author's vision of how these books can function. For minority students, they see themselves in the stories, and it affirms their humanity and their existence, helps them feel less alone, less alienated, and increases a sense of belonging. For the non-minority students, in other words, white people, they will grow in their understanding that they are only one of many groups. They are not special, and they will increase in their empathy and understanding for minority groups. So these are the mirrors. And it is crucial for children from historically marginalized groups to view themselves in the books that they read. It is also vital for children in the majority culture to see themselves, to see representations of minority cultures. Otherwise, they will have an exaggerated view of their importance and ethnocentrism. For the white student, they don't view the literature so much as a mirror, but as a window. The windows are books that give readers from a different culture a glimpse into the lives and experiences of others from one culture to another. And so this might help African-American students peer into the culture of a Korean student through a book that is read. And so this is why now we are in a national conversation about what books children ought to be able to have access to. What I want you to understand is that this issue of representation of windows and mirrors, okay, is now we are, you know, far from 1990, but the principle that is in this essay from 1990 has now become kind of an axiom, such a moral good that we have the American Library Association wanting to put forward protection and a vision along with the National Education Association, the NEA, which is the largest lobbying group for public school teachers. They want to tell us that it's vital for students to have access to books that feature characters, not simply from just different cultures or races, or maybe have socioeconomic struggles, but they are pushing everything on the LGBTQ spectrum and all that that involves. And the reason that these books are being put before our kids is because of this principle, I think, of windows and mirrors, that they've just extended the principle now beyond race or socioeconomic status or culture to issues of sexuality and looking at showing them books with characters who are experiencing, you know, kind of going through those initial experiences of going and exploring and having curiosity with the alphabet community. And so this literature is seen as a powerful tool for building empathy and understanding and compassion in students. But again, it's gone far beyond just race or socioeconomic status. Now we're venturing into the realm of these experiences, even for middle schoolers and teenagers, into indoctrination into the alphabet ideology. Here's a quote from the article. Dr. Bishop says, when there are enough books available that can act as both mirrors and windows for all our children, then they will see they can celebrate both our differences and our similarities. So this is kind of the shell game that is being played. Now, I want to encourage you again to go read the article by Dr. Bishop. It's a helpful article. It's an interesting article. It's a foundational article. To some degree, I can see how exposing children to other cultures could be a good thing. It could be an educational thing. In principle, I'm not against that. But how the ideology of representation has evolved And this is where we are going, and what is underpinning, in my opinion, again, the framework and the practices of people like the NEA and the librarian groups that want to give children unrestricted access to books explaining certain sexual experiences, and to see themselves in that as a way of affirming them and helping them to feel connected to all of humanity. So that's kind of how the idea of representation was started and how it is evolving. Okay, so let's go back to this Gloat article for a minute. I want to read a couple more quotes. So again, in the workplace, now we're switching from children's literature to the workplace. Diversity is about bringing together people from all walks of life. So that's what we talked about last week, bringing them into the workplace and changing your hiring practices. Representation ensures that these diverse employees and their viewpoints can be found or depicted across all departments and seniority levels within the organization. Okay, let's go to the next one. Representation is about, and here's this wording, this is what I want you to notice, is about seeing people of all backgrounds making meaningful contributions throughout every level and department within your organization. Let's go to the next. And notice up there all the categories: sex, socioeconomic background, upbringing, religion, education, sexual orientation, ethnicity, neurodiversity, and life experience. So this is what we are trying to find representatives from all of these people to be at the table in our organization. Okay, let's go on to the next one. This, when people see members of their group, it sends an implicit message that, or when people don't see members of their group, it sends an implicit message that there may not be many growth opportunities at that company. And this is the key to understanding why representation matters in the workplace. There is this broad thought that if I don't see people who look like me, particularly not just working there, but in leadership, then it sends a message to me as maybe an entry-level employee, there's no room for advancement here. I am not going to succeed. This is the mindset that is allegedly is built in the workplace. And so it's not simply enough. Diversity only gets people with these various backgrounds in the door. But representation is what you need to do to is the kind of core principle of making sure that people are advancing in a meaningful way and participating in leadership. So, for example, and again, this is part of the cure, is making sure that you have leaders that are members of historically marginalized groups and that they are represented in a meaningful way. So going back to our matrix of oppression from last week, this is sort of the key to understanding what representation is morphing into. So if you look at the targeted social groups in the fourth column here, you can see how, well, okay, some of this is about race or culture, women, biological women. But then we get into the alphabet issues, and these are considered also to be a historically marginalized group. So we need to have leadership that and representation of at the leadership level of all of these groups. So we need to have a neurodivergent person or some other disabilities, and we need to have Muslims, and we need to have members of the alphabet community and people who have various socioeconomic backgrounds. So that is why we're seeing so much messaging and imaging that looks like this picture that I'm going to have Bob put up on the screen here is if I go on Canva, which is a program that I use to build a lot of the thumbnails and graphics you see me use on social media, and you type in the word interracial or diversity, you see images like this all over the place. And if you type in inter-ethnic families, you get gay people. Well, wait a minute. Why am I getting a bunch of pictures of gay couples if I'm looking for inter-ethnic families? It's because we're not going to show white people. Notice that there's no members of the privileged groups in this picture. Huh? Well, he's in the marginalized group. Bob's asking, what is the guy in the wheelchair white? Possibly, but he's what they call racially ambiguous. And even if he is white, he's okay because he's disabled. And so that means he's in the historically marginalized group. So if you notice in a lot of marketing these days, start looking for white men who are not gay. Like, I don't like using the word straight because there's no such thing as straight, but just a typical white dude who is kind of muscular and not effeminate. You know, there's not many of those in marketing campaigns anymore. If you do see a white person, they're generally in some other marginalized group, such as being disabled or being a member of the alphabet community, because those are the okay white people. But we aren't thinking about, you know, how are we going to make sure that we have diversity and that we are really making place at the table for everybody, making sure everybody's represented. That's not representation. Representation is not making sure that we have Christians or white people, or unless they're women, so I should say white men, or people who are, for lack of a better term, heteronormative, which, again, I don't like using that word because it causes me to participate in the insanity, but you know what I mean. And that you don't, that's not representation. Representation only counts, and what it has morphed into is people who belong to the marginalized group. And so that's why, you know, someone like Larry Elder running for president is not seen as helping to reach diversity goals because he doesn't buy into the framework of the critical social theory. Somebody like Monique doesn't help a company reach their diversity goals. She is not seen as a good example of representation. Because it is not simply that you belong to the category, it's that you also uphold the ideology of the matrix of oppression, that this is a way that we ought to organize humanity and a lens through which we should see people and their value and worth. Now, if there is a DEI officer out there in the world, you can write to me, who thinks that having a place at the table and preserving seats at the table for people in the privileged category of the matrix of oppression, does that represent representation? Send me your training notes where you say that. But usually what it is that it is assumed that those people are present. They don't need representation. Okay. All right, so I just went through the Representation Matters hashtag last night on Twitter and grabbed a bunch of things that all fly under the banner of representation. So here's one. Happy Brain Awareness Week. Black is beautiful and more representation is needed in medical art. So the idea here is that when you see illustrations in medical textbooks, it's usually white people. So this is a person who's trying to advocate for representation of Black people in medical art drawings. Okay, that's an interesting thing. I don't know how prevalent that is. I don't know if that's a real problem. Maybe it is a real problem, but it's an observation. And so this is what is flying under the banner of representation, is we need to see more minorities represented in medical textbooks. All of the models should not be white people. Okay, let's go on to the next example. All right, so here's an assembly woman, Brittany Miller. I don't know who she is. She is some sort of assembly government person in Nevada. Record number of Asian Americans filed to run for Nevada legislature. 9 to be exact, 7 incumbents. The diversity growth since I was first elected in 2016 is amazing. A government of the people that looks like the people. So this is representation. Now, I could possibly get behind a vision of, you know, sometimes some cultures, they live in groups. You know, here in Southern California, if you go down to certain areas in Orange County, it's highly Asian. You know, sometimes Koreans live in one area or Chinese live in one area. And, you know, maybe it would be important for somebody who is a cultural native to represent those people. I could maybe see a case for that. But I think more importantly is I want my representatives to represent my ideology, my worldview. I personally do not vote for people based on race. I vote for people based on their policy advocacy. I want to agree with people on how they vote certain particular matters that are of a lot of importance to me on the local level and the national level. So if we're talking about representation, in other words, I need to see people who look like me representing me at the government level, I'll be like, well, that's really not what factors into my thinking. For me personally, I want to vote for people who share my worldview and that sort of a thing. But this would be another version, another manifestation of representation in our culture. Okay, let's go on to the next one. This would be representation in history. This is from the state of Wisconsin, and they recently passed an initiative to incorporate Asian and Pacific Islander history across Wisconsin. And it has been unanimously passed into law. Asian American and Pacific Islander history will be taught in our public schools. Well, this would be another form of representation. Now, maybe there could be a case for that if, you know, there's important people who have made meaningful contributions to our country as Americans from an Asian background and Pacific Islander background. And so we want to like fill in some gaps. And it's much like we say that African-American history is American history, and or Black history is American history. We could say Asian and Pacific Islander history is American history. And so we're just filling out the narrative and giving a fuller narrative. Okay, I could maybe see a case for that. But if it's handled and taught in such a way that, hey, we're going to just slice up the pie and this is one more thing of division, and, you know, we just want to have, you know, our seed of representation too. I don't know, you know, like have to weigh that out as to how constructive that is for the culture that we want to build. That might just bring more division. But again, this is how representation shows up in real life. Now, if we go way down the rabbit hole, this one is a little bit more extreme, this example. This woman, who appears to be white, says she's watching, I'm assuming, a show called Push. I don't know anything about this show. On CBC, which I think is Canadian Broadcasting, and hearing a quad mom, which I'm assuming is a quadriplegic mom, is really reducing my internalized ableism. So happy to finally see a physically disabled mother on Canadian television. Thank you, CBC, for showcasing this representation. So what she's saying here in the social justice speak is that she's watching a show where there's a mother who's a quadriplegic, and that it is kind of breaking down some of her thoughts of what a quadriplegic mom can do, and that maybe she's more able than was previously assumed. You know, and this kind of is, I think there's a version of soft representationism that could be helpful. For example, Bethany Hamilton lost her arm in a tragic shark accident a number of years ago. And she runs a foundation to help encourage young people who have also lost a limb, and that they see her as a role model, as somebody like, oh, I can identify with her. That inspires me to do more with my life. That form of soft representation, I can kind of see a case for. I don't know if anyone's old like me. If you remember a show back in the late 80s called Life Goes On, and it featured a character who had Down syndrome, and he was on the show, and a show I enjoyed in the 80s, The Facts of Life, there was a recurring character who had cerebral palsy. And so when you see somebody like that out there in the public space, that form of representation, it can help to inspire me of, you know, as I watch that, to see what's possible. But it could also inspire a young person to see themselves, if they are disabled, to see themselves in that person and what's possible. So that form of representation, I can kind of understand. And I'm going to just list a few more examples here from my own life. Recently, my daughter took me to a concert. Many of you know that I'm a Johnny Cash fan. I have a Johnny Cash shirt on today. And she took me to a Johnny Cash concert, and they had a cover band there playing the hits from Johnny Cash. And it was very elaborate. It was very nice. And the gal playing the lead guitar in the cover band was older than me. And she was in this band with all these young people, and they were all singing and playing live Johnny Cash cover songs. And I thought, this is so interesting. And I realized in that moment that I don't see many women my age and older platformed very often in public. And there she was, the lead guitarist, and the leading all of these young people. And she had actually was friends with Johnny Cash when she was a young woman, and had played with him on a couple of occasions. And I thought, yeah, there was a sense in me of, wow, that's so inspirational. Because sometimes, if I'm honest, I have doubts about myself. And I talk about this sometimes with my kids, of like, how I doubt myself as I'm getting older. Do I really have anything to contribute anymore? As I see young and upcoming apologists, and I'm like, you know, I don't know that I can compete with that. And they say things so much better than I do, and so much more of an entertaining way. And do I really have anything to contribute? And I have a lot of self-doubt. And when I saw that gal up there, playing the guitar, I thought, I came away from the concert, and I told my daughter, I said, you know, I know representation sometimes can devolve into this weird world, but I will have to say, in all honesty, it inspired me to see somebody who was in my stage of life up there doing something she really obviously loved. She was smiling from ear to ear through the whole concert, and leading those young people and probably teaching them to some degree on how to play the songs. I said, it inspires me to continue going in my ministry. It inspires me to keep making content, because look at her and what joy she brings to everybody in playing this music. Maybe I can do something on some tiny level in my own ministry in that. So for me in that moment, I could see, well, yeah, sometimes representation is nice. Now, is it the be all, end all? I don't know about that. I went to seminary 30 years ago. It was a good old boys club. It was a lot of men. I was the only woman in my program. And I made it anyways. And as my grandfather told me a long time ago, somebody has to be the pioneer. And so I think that representation is nice, but I'm not sure that it's as vital for survival as it's being put forward out there. That's an opinion. But here's where representation is going. I mentioned earlier about the books and the alphabet community themed books that they are trying to make available in an unrestricted way for children and young people. If we look at the matrix of oppression, we notice, you know, the alphabet community is on there and it's one of the historically marginalized groups. So if I, as a Christian organization, am going to say, well, I'm going to participate with representation along the lines of race and gender, my question to you then is going to be, by what standard do you stop with just race and gender? Because the LGBT community are now seen and called as sexual minority voices. Why would you not, why would you stop with only with representation at the level of race and gender? If you're going to be consistent and you think that the matrix of oppression is a real lens through which we should look through and evaluate and judge and organize humanity, then why would you not include a place at the table in leadership in your Christian organization, your church, to have members that are considered sexual minority voices? Some people would ask the question further, what about other religions? Shouldn't they also have a place at the table? Shouldn't they also be represented? Last night, again, I went on the Representation Matters hashtag on Twitter. And as you can see in this tweet, this is a message. There was a video attached to this by a writer director on creating queer characters. And this was under the Representation Matters banner. So what you have to understand is that out in the real world, representation is not simply about hiring more women or hiring African Americans. It is about expanding into the alphabet community and making sure that you have lesbian flicks, that you have proper representation at the table, even at the leadership level, for these sexual minority voices. And that can be the slippery slope at which representation can go down. And so we have to be thoughtful. We have to be careful. We have to think about these things through the lens of the Christian worldview. Is there a case for some version of representation that can be encouraging where we see ourselves or our kids see ourselves? I think that that can be helpful at times. Is it necessary for proper psychological development, emotional development? I question that. I'm a skeptic of that. Is it necessary in order for me to feel like I can advance in my career? I'm a skeptic of that. I think that's more about mindset. It's more about what you emphasize and your own identity, how you see yourself. So those are some of my opinions and thoughts about the issue of representation. So anyways, those are some of my thoughts. Thanks for joining me. Thank you for enduring the substitute teacher here at the family meeting. Hopefully Monique will be back once her class is over. If you like this content, let me know. I could maybe develop one or two more teachings along the DEI stream and just try to explain it to you a little bit more so you can have better conversations. And that's really my goal here, is for you to to equip you to have better, more productive conversations. It's really not helpful when we just shut down every conversation. Hopefully I've given you some of the things to think about that when you do find yourself all of a sudden in a conversation about DEI issues, you have some kind of intelligent mental hooks and ways of talking about it, questions you can ask, and always ask for definitions and why questions. Why is that important? How did you arrive at that conclusion? That sort of a thing. Anyways, I do look forward to your feedback. I hope you're finding these teachings helpful, and we will talk to you again soon. God bless.